Welcome back to the 4 o'clock hour of the Tom and Curley Show. Tom Tangney here, John Curley away for the day. He'll be back tomorrow. Sherry Elliker, getting to be a regular around here, Sherry, filling in for John. And we appreciate you doing that. By the way, in case I don't think you've had the chance to meet our excellent producer, Jacob, in person, Sherry, but Jacob is the best producer, bar none, at Cairo Radio, and here's why.
जल स्रोता को धानी देसा छैना पिउने पानी
नदी नाला सुके सके धारा को अपानी.
That there is the current Guinness Book of World Record holders version of 345?
65, I think, and it's 360. Called Melancholy.
That's called Melancholy. That's right. In case you are just joining us, our last segment was about this sort of death metal song with 400 individual solos, 37 minutes long, that's going for the Guinness Book of World Records. And this is the song that it has to best with, as Sherry mentioned, 365 singers. You noted that it's from Nepal, and I would think this is a much easier, like a long, cool drink of water to quaff your thirst more than the screaming death metal version, eh?
I think this is, yes, it's lovely, and Tracy may want to consider this as a traffic bed.
That's right.
A little, it's hauntingly beautiful, as they say.
There you go. soothe our souls a bit. So
right.
Anyway, great work, Jacob, tracking
yes.
That down. As sort of behind the scenes, neither Sherry nor I could find the death metal version. Jacob went the extra mile and found that, and then found the current record holder. So
now
okay.
Jacob's next job has to be to find the perfect thing for John Curley to get into the Guinness World Book of Records. If
yeah,
he's that good of a producer,
right.
His challenge is now to take it one step further, not just find recordings of things, but actually find the thing that's going to put him over the top.
Have any suggestions already off the top of your head, Jacob?
Well, if John had 401 friends, I think that he would already be trying to do this one.
That's not a bad idea.
That's very funny. Okay. Don't tell him we said that, right? Okay, enough frivolity and enough Nepalese music, although I wouldn't mind hearing that bumping in and out for the rest of the show if it was it was up to me. But that's the producer's call. We're moving. This is another interesting story. It's part of perhaps a national movement, but certainly it has local ramifications. I'm old enough to remember what is now kind of seen by a lot of us, at least, as a kind of a misguided effort at cracking down on crime in the 1990s, that there was something very popular here and elsewhere called the Three Strikes Law. And if you were considered a habitual criminal, which meant that you committed three crimes in the span of, I don't know how many years, you know, a decade or something, that you would be automatically sentenced for life and sentenced to life in prison for the three crimes that you committed. And now there is a movement afoot, and Dan Satterberg, who's the King County prosecutor, has long been fighting for this and has gotten this overturned, that three strikes and you're out is unnecessarily harsh, especially by certain standards. And we're going to have Hannah Scott is, I think she's off this week, but she put together a piece sort of explaining the stance of the three strikes law in current kind of jurisdictional issues.
In the last 2 weeks, Washington has seen two inmates serving life without parole under the so-called three strikes law get resentenced and released from prison under a new law the prosecutors say was long overdue to fix a broken system that left dozens of people, mostly people of color, to rot in our prisons for crimes that don't match the time.
Last year, you did an important thing by taking robbery 2 off of the list of persistent offenses. That's something I've always advocated. It's the lowest crime on that list of persistent offenses. It's the most common, and it's the most racially disproportionate.
King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg earlier this year, as he urged the legislature to pass a bill, Democratic sponsor and Senator Jeannie Darnielle explained, was necessary to ensure more than 100 people aren't left to die in prison for the crime of second-degree robbery, which had been considered a strike until lawmakers removed it from the list of strikeable offenses. The problem, Darnielle explained, was that they did not make that law retroactive.
The focus here is on giving prosecutors the tools they need to do that, to be fair in our approach and go back and apply this law retroactively, to recognize that we have great racial disproportionality in the persons that are impacted by having not made this law retroactive 2 years ago. 46% of those persons are Black. Additionally, 45% are over the age of 55, so unlikely to have more criminal activity.
Okay, and so if there's some confusion about what exactly is second-degree robbery, it's typically a robbery without a deadly weapon or significant injury to victims. And the legislature, in its wisdom, just decided, yeah, you know, that as a strikes go, that's more of a foul tip. That doesn't really feel like a real strike, and so they took it off, but didn't make it retroactive. And so now there are, I think there's something like as many as 144 instances of three strikes law that are going to be reexamined and sort of resentenced. If the robbery, second degree robbery, was one of your three strikes, that you have a chance for sort of a readjudicated sentence. And then one last thing from Hannah. She now profiles the story of Russell Harvey, he was going to be the first, and now it turns out he's going to be the second one released because of the decades he spent in jail already because of a second degree robbery, three strikes.
Last week, Russell Harvey, a 60-year-old man who served nearly a quarter century of his life without parole sentence for second-degree robberies, got his shot at resentencing, first reading an emotional statement to the court that Lee explained.
It was a tearjerker. He had everyone in the courtroom tearing up because of just the story that he shared, which was a statement that he had also included in his court materials, his filed materials with the court. Just expressing just, you know, the hardship of having gone through prison, having had a hard life, and disappointing his mom. That was something that was really heartbreaking for him, is that he felt like he was a disappointment to his mother.
Sadly, Harvey's mother passed away earlier this year, just before he was released from prison.
Okay, so Sherry, I think this is a good thing. I've never supported the three strikes law. I understand the frustration. I was an adult in the 90s, and I remember the frustration people had with the rising crime rate. But whenever you have a mandatory anything, it feels like it doesn't allow for enough nuance, and to include something like second degree robbery as one of the three strikes just struck me as, you know, as beyond the pale, and it may have taken us 30 years, but I think we're now finally righting an overreaction wrong in the process. How say you?
I agree with you, Tom, and I think I've talked about this with John, but I don't think I've talked about it with you. I was in radio for a long time, and then as cities often do, they hire former communications persons to run their communications department, and I was the director of communications for the Maryland State Prison System. And so I have sort of a firsthand look at what prison is about. And my opinion is that, you know, we need to have criminal justice reform in this country. The man that Hannah was talking about in this story, I mean, he committed some robberies. He didn't have a gun. He didn't hurt anybody. And for him to sit in prison for over 25 years is an atrocity to me. I mean, yeah. You don't really get, even the best prison systems, you don't really get rehabilitated. There are drugs and violence and all kinds of things. Families are broken apart. It's a very tragic thing to have happen. So if we can keep nonviolent offenders along with drug addicts and people that, you know, are not going to be necessarily helped by the prison experience, I think we should use everything we can to make that happen. And that's not to say to be soft on crime or on violent offenders. That's a totally different story. Some people need to be out of society. But for people that are low-level offenders, putting them in prison, it just doesn't help. It doesn't help. It ruins their lives and their families' lives most of the time. And reentry, most states don't have great reentry programs. So to get back into society is really difficult.
Yeah, John is a little, let's say, just, you know, to make it simple, to keep the stereotypes alive, John being on the right and me being on the left. John's maybe a little tougher on criminals than I am, but John himself has interviewed many people that have gotten out of prison after, you know, X amount of decades through his kind of charity work. And he says that, yeah, these stories are just heartbreak stories, and it's like, the prison often hardens you and makes you a more effective criminal, and certainly doesn't make you better for society. And society cracking down this hard can backfire on one. And so John has a very kind of sympathetic look at what it's like to be behind bars. Not that he doesn't, like me, he doesn't think that, you know, there shouldn't be people behind bars. People have, you know, you have to be accountable for your actions. But he's very sympathetic about the difficulties of when someone, unless you're in prison for life, when you get out, society is set up against you. And that's why we're sort of passing laws that you can't ask somebody if they have a criminal conviction, if you're trying to rent to them or trying to hire them until you get to a certain level in the interview process and all of this, that the reentry is as difficult as difficult gets. And John is very sympathetic to the plight of people. I mean, you have a choice between, you mentioned last time you worked with me that, you know, you were a renter. You know, you had a rental. And if it's like, if you had a choice between somebody who had a criminal record and someone who didn't, obviously, you know, your instincts are right to say, well, I just soon go with somebody who doesn't have a criminal record. Right. But how is somebody with a criminal record, however long ago it was, ever going to be able to find shelter or a job or anything else if we don't at least take that into consideration? And on this, I know you said this wasn't the Tom and Sherry soft on crime segment, but it's starting to feel this way because our next story, I also find encouraging that this comes out of Illinois, you know, the great Midwest of this country, that they've just now decided to ban, with bipartisan support, ban police deception to young suspects. We've got a little clip here with describing the situation in Illinois and the case it involved.
Oh, sorry. Is the case in Illinois also the case of Brandon Dassey? This might be a separate case.
Oh, okay. So I just saw this as minor interrogations.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. Sorry, but this is another case, but it's from a TED talk from a psychologist named Lindsay Malloy, and she's talking about the psychology behind certain. Oh,
okay. So we should hold off that for just a second. And I'll try to set this up. So what they say, a lot of the public doesn't realize this. I think if you watch enough, you know, cop shows or, you know, detective movies, this might not be that big a surprise. But the suggestion here in this article is that a lot of the public doesn't realize that police routinely lie in their interrogations of suspects as a way to kind of, you know, elicit information that they might not otherwise been able to get. So you can lie and say, listen, we have your DNA at the scene of the crime. That's not the case. But if you tell them that, then they kind of, and then they get a confession that, then they'll sort of, you know, prompt themselves to confess to something. And they say that, there's a high percentage of teens who, when interrogated by police through this kind of deceptiveness, end up falsely confessing because the teenager is so kind of daunted by the authority figures going after him or her that they feel like they don't have a fair shot, and as a result, there's been some a number of cases of miscarriage of justice in the like, and they say that you shouldn't be able to do that. Another thing that police are allowed to do until this Illinois law came along was they could say, hey, listen, you know, if you admit to this, you know, you can get out of here. We can let you go. But that's an out-and-out lie, so the teenager admits to it. Then he's, you know, arrested and held in jail and goes to trial for something that he only admitted to because he was told that he'd be let go if he admitted to that. It's a concern that this the Illinois legislature has, and apparently now we have somebody, a TED Talk, talking about how easy it is for juveniles to be unfairly tricked into confessing, false or true.
In March of 2006, police interrogated Brendan Dassey, a 16-year-old high school student with an IQ around 70, putting him in the range of intellectual disability. So here's just a brief snippet of his four-hour interrogation.
Brandon, be honest. I told you before, that's the only thing that's going to help you here. We already know what happened. Okay? If we don't get honesty here, I'm your friend right now. But I gotta believe in you. And if I don't believe in you, I can't go to bat for you. Okay? You're nodding. Tell us what happened.
Your mom said you'd be honest with us.
And she's behind you 100% no matter what happens here.
That's what she said. Because she thinks you know more, too.
We're in your corner.
We already know what happened. Now tell us exactly. Don't lie.
They told Brendan that honesty would set him free. But they were completely convinced of his guilt at that point. So by honesty, they meant a confession. And his confession would definitely not end up setting him free. They eventually got a confession from Brendan that didn't really make sense, didn't match much of the physical evidence of the crime, and is widely believed to be false. Still, it was enough to convict Brendan and sentence him to life in prison for murder and sexual assault in 2007.
Okay, another example that should horrify all of us. Now, Sherry, with your experience in the Department of Corrections, you mentioned as a communications person, how say you about these kinds of issues? What have you seen?
Well, this Illinois is the first state to do this, Tom, but Oregon and New York are also considering similar laws, and New York is considering doing this for adults as well. I'm not so sure how I feel about that. But okay. I really feel very strongly about with minors. What you just heard is a really kind of nice example of how police can sometimes be to people, even though they're lying to him. But imagine the situation where you have two adults screaming at a kid, you know, where the kid is terrified and they don't know what to do and their parent isn't there and they don't have an attorney and they just want to get out. And they say, we can do whatever, you know, you'll get out of here if you just tell us this or you just tell us that. Remember, they want to win, okay? They don't necessarily aren't looking for justice at this point. And I'm not degrading cops. I'm just saying that they've got a job to do and they're going to do it. So I was talking to my old boss, who was head of juvenile services, and he said that, you know, the research shows that the brain of a minor, of someone that's, you know, 15, 16, 17 years old, isn't fully developed really until they're 21, just doesn't have the capacity to really withstand all of this. I hope this becomes a nationwide law. I really do. I think it's very important. I think it's very important to tell kids, you know, if they do get in trouble and they are interrogated, to require that a parent is there. Make sure that they have some support if they can. Because, you know, imagine how hard it would be to withstand that sort of pressure. It'd be awful. No wonder they cave.
Yeah, the highest profile case, I think, is the Central Park Five, who are now considered the exonerated five.
Right,
And they spent a good decade, I think, in prison unfairly. So, okay, thank you for that, Sherry. And I think I hear the, it's not a Nepalese music, but there is definitely Tracy Traffica Sounders there.
Yeah, it is.
Yes, indeed. You're listening to the Tom and Curly Show. Sherry Elicker filling in for John. And now, this is 4:30-ish. And this is when we turn to the Muckleshoot Casino and what they have to offer through the presence of one Rachel Bell.
That sounds like somebody who is highly educated, who is one moment away from their dissertation. Those were some big Scrabble words, my friend.
Well, you've earned almost every one of them. So, Rachel Bell, listen, I have a preview of your topic, and I love this topic. And something tells me that this might get to the essence of who Rachel Bell is, in addition to the rest of us. So why don't you launch right in and tell us what you're about?
Yes, I think that you and I probably have this in common. So there's an article on Medium called How Too Much Comfort is Making You Miserable. There's a new book called The Comfort Crisis by a guy named Michael Easter. And he thinks, his theory is that modern life might be too cushy for our emotional and psychological well-being. Basically, the idea is we have too many ups, too many highs. All of our needs are taken care of. Therefore, we are miserable. And some of that might be evolutionary. So what he says is, you know, if all your needs are thoroughly and perpetually satisfied. Things like food, shelter, safety, warmth, basic needs that our ancestors thousands of years ago wouldn't have had an easy time with. What happens is you stop appreciating what you have, and then you also, as he put it, move your goalposts and fixate on what's next, what's next. So mm-hmm. after each big task, like, oh, I graduated college. Ooh, I got a job. Now I got a car. Ooh, I got married. I had kids. It never ends. Like, you're constantly trying to get to the next thing. So the thing that he says that he believes helps with this social conditioning is to make yourself physically uncomfortable. Like, go on a backpacking trip where you're cold or you don't eat as soon as you get hungry. He recommends being hungry for a few days, just being uncomfortable. And he said after doing that, he realized that 99% of his life was completely wonderful, but he was too fixated on the remaining 1% to notice. So it's basically the contrast in life. In order to have good, you have to be acquainted with the bad.
And he fully acknowledges that this is, you know, a problem for the, you know, the 1% in effect.
Yes.
That this is wonderful for those of us who feel like all of our physical needs are, you know, shelter and food, that our life is relatively, you know, good. He's not saying that if you happen to be poor or starving or yes. homeless or out of a job that your life is, you know, hey, just to, you know, smell the roses, darn it, and get over it kind of stuff. This is more kind of the problems of those of us who are more or less satisfied and yet still unsatisfied. I think this just rang true. It just made a lot of sense to me that I think a lot of times they say this about the rich as well. So I grew up, you know, we're, you know, middle class or lower middle class. My dad was a high school teacher's entire career. My mom was a 50s housewife. And so, you know, we didn't have a lot of money, but he, you know, they raised five happy kids and it was a great life. And you always say, well, gee, I wonder what it would be like to be rich. Well, I think the rich have these kinds of, if you think that in general, Western, you know, civilization allows for us to be a little pampered, I think it's tough for the rich maybe to appreciate all that they have, because what you focus on is what you don't have, like, oh, well, that guy's yeah. richer or whatever. And it's, you've got to focus on what you do have and appreciate it, and what you don't have shouldn't bother you. But if you have 99% of everything you need, it's that 1% that's probably going to rankle.
Well, they said mm-hmm. there hasn't been a lot of research on how physical discomfort can make you happier, but there was a paper written in 2008 on the merits of taking cold showers to help treat depression. And the author of the study said it worked for him and many of his friends. And the idea is, his hypothesis is that part of depression could stem from a lifestyle that, quote, lacks certain physiological stressors that have been experienced by primates through millions of years of evolution. The absence of physical stress may cause inadequate functioning of the brain, as in, we evolved to go through a certain amount of stress to find what you needed to eat that day or to make sure you had shelter. And if you don't have those things to worry about, our brains aren't functioning the same, and therefore you start worrying about things that don't matter, which is honestly the thing that I dislike about people most. So recently, and I hate to say this, you know, if my friends are listening, because I love my friends and I love hiking with them, but I have been hiking a little bit more on my own lately, and I did my first solo camping trip, and I plan to do another one soon because inevitably, you know, and if it's like a 5-6 hour hike, including being in the car 7-8 hours, the conversation will turn to, you know, people talking about what they don't like about their jobs or their relationship or, you know, their parents are ailing. And I love being outside in nature so much that I don't like to mix it with the boring / negative parts of real life. And I can't fully appreciate the thing that I love when that conversation's happening, because it's distracting me. And so I have chosen to, like, get out of that situation completely, because I think a lot of those complaints are valid. They're big things, but especially during COVID, if I have to hear someone one more time complain that their package isn't here yet that they ordered online, you know, I hate the word hate, but I hate those kind of complaints. Like, my Pilates class got moved to Fridays and now I can't go. Like, I get it that it changes your life, but the upsetness, if that's even a word, behind it, I think people get too, it's the don't sweat the small stuff. I do it too. Yeah. But I think it's a huge flaw in modern Western society.
So, Sherry, how much do you enjoy your cushy life?
I thought you'd never ask. So I think you're forgetting a segment of the population that's like me, who are giant babies. Like the idea of going without air conditioning or hot water or something like that is so awful to me. I am one of those people. You know, I am one of those people that needs all these creature comforts. So I just can't imagine that. I can't imagine. I'd rather agree. Okay, listen, I will take a moment every single day and appreciate the fact that I'm eating food or whatever. Just don't make me suffer. Okay, don't make me go without it. Don't make
but
me
I think...
go out, you know, and do all of that. I do try to be mindful of those things. But oh, yeah. I don't want to have to miss a meal. And
that's the whole point, though. That is the whole exact point. Nobody does. You know, nobody, I don't either. Nobody, that's why we eat when we're hungry and we put a sweater on when we're cold. The whole point is if you get uncomfortable, you can appreciate the better parts of life more. And in this article, they said, you know, hopefully people will take that with them as the pandemic ends. And, you know, you go back into regular life, that you can have an appreciation for what you're missing out on and not just go straight back into complaining and unappreciating.
So, Sherry, your life is miserable whether you realize it or not.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, ask my husband. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, that's a great, you know, just a quick kind of a personal note. When we grew up, so our family, we had like a great-great uncle who left us this ramshackle cabin, and it's shared by a bunch of, you know, related families up on Whidbey Island that I go to, you know, every August in my life. I've been up at the cabin, but it's really rustic. It's like, you know, there's no running water. There's an outhouse. I mean, it's not the ideal kind of life we have. And I remember we would go up there for 2 and 3 weeks at a time when I was like a kid, like in grade school. And it was so amazing to come back after living the cabin life for 3 weeks, to walk into the kitchen and see like the sink and running water and a porcelain toilet and all this. Like you just suddenly luxuriated in all of the things that you just didn't notice nine and a half months out of the year. It's like it really
the first shower that you take is the best shower. Oh.
Exactly. So at least our lives aren't as miserable as we realize.
That's serious.
So anyway, that's good. And she's happy for it, apparently.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. Let's turn to Tracy Taylor. Speaking of miserable, I hope that isn't the case out in the streets. Tom Tangney here. This is the Tom and Curly Show. Sherry Elliker filling in for John, who will be back tomorrow. So this next story, I get a kick out of these kinds of stories. A lot of people get kind of a negative kick out of these stories because they think it's so infuriating and ridiculous, the art world. We've got, in fact, I'm kind of tempted. Sherry, do you want to try to explain what this story is?
Sure. So it's basically a story about an artist from Italy. His name is Salvatore Garou, maybe? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, he has just sold a sculpture for $18,000.
No big deal.
No big deal, exactly. Except the sculpture, which is called Buddha in Contemplation, happens to be, wait for it, invisible. Completely invisible. Yes, its materials are made from air and spirit. So he says that, you know, this is kind of like the energy is condensed. It's transformed into particles. And it's much like how we shape a god we've never seen. So it's he says it's a real thing, that even though you can't see it, you can't feel it, you can't touch it, it's really there. And somebody out there paid $18,000 for it.
And not only that, there are conditions, despite the fact that, you know, no one can see it. It has to be on display.
Who's that?
In a 5-foot by 5-foot square, and must be displayed in a private space free from obstructions where lighting and climate control are not required. So this is clearly like this guy takes himself very seriously. And at the same time, it feels like an utter joke. And when you look at this story, the people are just, you know, the comments are just like, oh my God, you know, there's an idiot born every minute. There's a sucker born every minute. And this is kind of like, this is the guy's the P.T. Barnum of art. And I've got to say, I understand the outrage, and it is ridiculous. But to me, it seems to be like this comes at the nexus of conceptual art, which is a movement, you know, a few decades old. And the point of conceptual art is that the idea or concept involved in the work takes precedent over its physical manifestation. So oftentimes, one of my favorite works of conceptual art is this piece called One and Three Chairs. And what it is there's an actual chair, something that we would all recognize as a chair, a physical manifestation of a chair. And then there's a photo of a chair on the wall next to it. And then next to that, on the other side of the chair, is a dictionary definition of what a chair is. And it's called One and Three Chairs. People could say, this is ridiculous, but there is an idea behind it. The physical manifestation, we could all go get a chair, take a picture of a chair, and print the dictionary definition. But the fact that this guy came up with it first and came up with this idea of it has some kind of historical art history record. Also, then combine that notion with this non-fungible tokens business. I don't know if you've done much looking at this NFT stuff, but this is really crazy, where there's some image that you can sell, and it's sold for tens of thousands of dollars, this particular image, and somehow you own it, even though anybody can get it on the internet and reprint it a million times, but you are the sole owner of that. It seems to me that this particular piece of work is at the nexus of non-fungible tokens and conceptual art, and it's the historical aspect of it rather than the physical manifestation of it that makes it of some note, I would guess.
Yeah, one of the comments, you were mentioning the comments after that I thought was the funniest, is I hope that they wrote it on an invisible check.
Exactly, that's right.
I mean, I agree. I think, you know, in the art world, I mean, yes, we do have to suspend our disbelief occasionally and appreciate these different types of art. But this one is a little tough to swallow, I got to tell you.
I don't know, man. 18,000 sounds like a steal.
Yeah.
Okay, and speaking of steals, no. Tracy Taylor, how are we looking at the as we wrap up the 4 o'clock hour?
Miserable.